This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 13th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape today. In the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, as I am out working in preparation to fill in for Chris Hayes on Up With Chris, both Saturday morning and Sunday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, on all of your, well, I guess, cable MSNBC stations. DVR it if you're not going to be able to watch it. Never hurts to get good numbers. But for me, it's all about being able to host one of my favorite shows and to, without any sense of guilt or any sort of bashfulness, eat every single piece of pastry on that plate. Like, I can't wait to, like, eat it before they even get it out there. You'll have to go out and get more. On the program today, we'll be talking to Glenn Greenwald of The Guardian about the recent, I guess, closing of any attempts by the Obama administration to pursue any of the incredible violations regarding torture. We'll go over this with Glenn, but they declined to pursue the authors of the torture memos. They declined to pursue anyone who followed the torture memos. They pursued for some time those who actually tortured outside of the parameters of the torture memos. They closed the door on that investigation, and then they pursued people who actually killed people via torture, and then they closed the door on that. So we will talk to Glenn Greenwald about that in just a moment. And before we get to Glenn Greenwald, update from Jeff Smith, who will let us know what's going on with Occupy Wall Street. On Monday, I will be out for the Rosh Hashanah holiday. We will have a new interview for you, one that I'm recording actually as I speak. Well, not as I speak, but it gets complicated because we're shifting through the time-space continuum. And we will also have a report from Matt and Michael, who are going to go out with a tape recorder. Not a tape recorder, but, you know, a recording device. And they're going to record the happenings on the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. Jeff Smith will be here to let us know about that as well. So stick around. Tomorrow on the program, there will be no program on Friday. Like I say, I'll be prepping for Up With Chris. Monday, new programming. Tuesday, new programming of next week. Enjoy. Make sure you tune in. Also, if you're in Brooklyn, September 23rd, StrangeAngels.com will be doing a live event. Check it out at strangeangels.com. All right. See you soon.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, the listeners of the Majority Report, you can get a free Audible downloadable book at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Choose the one you want, but why not get The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals by Jane Mayer. Just to follow up on the lack of accountability of our torture regime, that's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. It's free. It helps the show. It helps you. Do it now.
Race hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know.
We are back on the Majority Report. Sam Cedar here on the phone, freelance journalist Jeff Smith, to give us a little bit of a preview of what we can anticipate coming out of Monday's one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. Jeff, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
All right. Well, so we're 1 year out. I guess a year ago on a Saturday, we had, it will be, of course, on Monday, the 17th. But a year ago, people gathered in Zuccotti Park. And over the next week or two, the number of people who were camping out there grew exponentially. I know you were one of the first people down there on the scene. What should we anticipate happening on Monday?
Well, I think, first of all, leading up to the actual Monday's anniversary, there are actions and events that are scheduled over the weekend on Saturday and Sunday as well. And so what I think you'll see there is a little bit of what's been going on sort of quietly behind the scenes, really since last year, particularly during the spring and summer months, was something that they called the Occupy Town Square. And so it's basically just a mobile setup that has education and teach-ins, things like that. And so it'll be happening at Washington Square Park on that Saturday, and it'll start about 10:30 in the morning. And, it hopes to basically launch another season's worth of getting really the issues back into play. I mean, the real value of Occupy Wall Street ultimately was that it was able to, instead of making it about actual protesting or camping or things like that, it really did change the subject and tone of the conversation. And so I think that, unfortunately, what we've seen now is that the corporate media sort of figured out a way to actually not talk about the issues of inequality and corporate crime, et cetera, and really was able to sort of turn it back into cops versus protesters and that sort of thing. And so I know that has really frustrated the movement to a degree. So I think, again, to be able to sort of focus back on the real issues that are important that Occupy Wall Street was really founded on. And so, I think student debt is going to, again, emerge as a really important issue now that we're going back into the fall. I think environmental issues are going to be something that you're going to see a lot more of. In particular, on Saturday, there's going to be a Spectra pipeline protest action, and that's where the Sunday morning is going to kick off. And then, obviously on the 17th, it's going to be another attempt to sort of have some civil disobedience and get in the streets down at Wall Street. And so it's going to start at 7 a.m., and I think it will be similar to what we've seen in the past in terms of just trying to block traffic and force some attention onto issues. We'll see how successful it is. But, again, I would really point out that what's most important, I think, is getting behind some of the issues that really change the conversation. And I think that's really what has been so great about the Chicago teacher strike, is that it's all of a sudden made an issue of education, particularly where Obama's education platform, and certainly anti-union practices have kind of have merged together, and these are issues that were really not part of the discussion before. So, you know, I think that there's a great appetite for a lot of these subjects, and so I think that activism is going to continue to be around those issues. And I think it's always been really the what has separated Occupy Wall Street almost from every one of the other so-called political movements going on right now, is that it really is issue-based, and it's nonpartisan in a way that's really, I think, different than almost anything else out there.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, I mean, do you think to a certain extent that has hurt it in some instances? I'm not making a value judgment here, but I mean, do you think that because it hasn't sort of fed into the, it hasn't provided the amount of value maybe, let's say, that Democrats wanted, that maybe it hasn't received the institutional support, or do you think that's simply just, that's not the case?
No, I mean, I think there's something to be said for that, but I'm not sure that in the end that is productive.
Right.
And so I think it's more promising to me to see the union element now becoming more militant and being willing to basically step away from the Democratic Party. And so, you know, I ultimately see the only way that a third party or a true, you know, independent political movement is going to actually have enough power to be electorally viable is that it's going to have to basically cleave off, you know, the leftward side of the Democratic Party, and maybe unions lead that, but also combine with that sort of, you know, Ron Paul right-wing party that is also, you know, ideologically unhappy with the corporate status quo. And so, you know, again, I think Occupy Wall Street had the chance to do that. But I think, a coalition in that way, I think, could be something that at that point might launch into electoral politics. But as it is right now, I think talking about the issues is enough of a game changer that that's really where the efforts are best put.
Why? Let me ask you this. I mean, Matt and I were talking about this the other day, and the idea of having this is the biggest action I think that we'll have seen since probably May, since May Day. And it having it on the anniversary of Occupy. I mean, if the idea is really about issues, what's the theory behind having it on Occupy? Is that just simply a marketing thing? Is it, I mean, I know this is a very sort of difficult time because I know that the news, it's almost impossible to get news generated around something that doesn't directly affect the presidential campaign. But give me your sense of why do it on the one-year anniversary. Am I reading too much into that?
No, I think that, you know, to a certain degree, the Occupy Wall Street's always been marked by a certain degree of, you know, it's for the participants, and, you know, in any way that they feel like it makes them feel better about the sort of sorry state of the world, that's also a function of it. And so I agree that it definitely seems a little insular to sort of celebrate your own anniversary, particularly of a tactic. You know, you wouldn't think of the Freedom Riders having a one-year anniversary, you know, maybe privately, something like that. But I think it's, in essence, that's really what it is for some of the people, is just sort of a private reunion or celebration of that. But I agree, outwardly, the optics don't really make a lot of sense. And frankly, I would be much more interested in seeing us, or see the Occupy movement take advantage of what's going on in Chicago right now, and just, you know, making that the focus, just because of the timing. I mean, having the ability and the nimbleness to make that kind of strategic move is also something that marked the movement, you know. Mm-hmm. And when something would happen on the West Coast in Oakland, to sort of see activists all over the country mobilize and, you know, bring that same issue all over the country, that was something that was pretty special about the movement. But it's a real quandary, I think, overall, because I think the police repression is frankly quite effective. And
right.
You know, we recently saw activists that were, you know, sleeping on the sidewalk strategically, trying to literally obey the laws that were allowed for political protests, while also staying out all night were found guilty. And I honestly am not going to be surprised if people that are arrested this coming 17th will end up doing some kind of jail time, because I think a lot of them that have been arrested multiple times now, the judges are ready to start putting them in. And, you know, it may be only 10 or 15 days, and they may serve 3 or 4 of those days, but still, it's all about ratcheting up and making people scared to do this. And, you know, I can't help but think, you know, imagine a world, or at least a New York City, where the First Amendment right was the most important priority for the police. And, when Occupy Wall Street broke out, the city was forced to bend over backwards to accommodate people. That's really the country that we should live in. I mean, this kind of public gathering for political purposes really should be the most important right that we have. And the fact that people seem okay with just widespread repression of these types of activities is really kind of disturbing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's one of the things that I think Occupy has done almost simply by its mere existence, is sort of expose certain problems that we have in society that we may not have recognized have been a problem or as problematic as they are. Where can people find out more info? And, well, before I ask you that, because I want to get a website, but are other Occupies across the country, are they engaging in activities on this day, on the 17th?
I don't know if specifically other cities at this point doing that. One of the things that is going on, certainly for this, is that people are coming, traveling from other cities to New York. And mm-hmm. So there have been programs set up to try and house people coming in from out of town and facilitate that. So I think the idea was, again, to sort of congregate in New York as sort of a, remembering what happened a year ago, but also to allow a lot of people, I think, that participated over the past year to come and meet people in New York for the first time. It's sort of the opposite of what you saw over the summer when people in New York traveled around to other parts of the country to try and do outreach. I think this is an opportunity for people to try and come to New York and share in that respect.
All right, great. And where can people find information online?
The website is s17nyc.org, and there's a full schedule there. And details for all the events.
Jeff Smith, always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for talking to us.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop globe. Exit wound in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. Water spine.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program, writing now for The Guardian UK, Glenn Greenwald. Thanks for joining us, Glenn.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, so Glenn, a couple of weeks ago, I guess now, during the Republican convention, and as such, this story maybe got less coverage than it should have, or maybe it would have gotten exactly the same amount of coverage, frankly. The door was basically, I guess the proper metaphor is to say that the book was finally closed on the torture practiced by our country during the Bush administration and any opportunity for accountability. Tell us basically what happened 2 weeks ago.
Well, basically, there were only two cases that the Obama Justice Department had said that they would investigate regarding the torture program. These were basically, if you recall, back in April and May of 2009, first the Obama administration said that they would not investigate anybody or hold accountable anybody who tortured people within the parameters of the Bush Justice Department memos. So the Bush Justice Department memo said that these techniques were legal, even though the U.S. had long recognized them as torture and the rest of the world does as well. The Obama administration said, as long as you stayed within the permission slips given by the Justice Department, we're not going to investigate you or hold you accountable. They also then said that anybody who wrote those memos or who authorized techniques that were torture also wouldn't be held accountable. The only people who they might investigate are people within the CIA or the military who tortured outside of the bounds of those permission slips, basically people who went so far beyond even the savagery that the Justice Department approved that they were basically rogue torturers. And the Justice Department said there were about 100 cases where the brutality was so shocking, where people died in custody, that they would investigate. They said this in 2010. In 2011, the Obama administration announced that they were closing the books on all 100 of even those cases that went beyond the torture memos, except for two particularly infamous, brutal cases where detainees died, one in Afghanistan in 2002, the other in Abu Ghraib in 2003 in Iraq, by being beaten, stripped, having cold water poured on them, freezing to death, and being beaten to death in the other case. And it was last 2 weeks ago that the Obama Justice Department said, even with regard to these two last cases, we have decided to close the books and not charge anybody or pursue it further, meaning that there will never be any accountability from the U.S. government for the systematic torture regime set up by the Bush administration.
Now, I just want to go back. I mean, now, if we were to sort of graph this, I mean, you can see how this is just basically, we're going to take this in phases, and we're going to sort of, expunge or whatever the verb would be here to sort of, I guess, filter out, and just, you know, one by one, we're going to take the most egregious, save it for the last. And it seems to me quite clear that there was never a scenario where throughout this process where anybody contemplated any real accountability, that it was simply, this is the way that we're going to manage this. And I just want to go back to what you said. People should understand that there were essentially four different categories of people here. One were, I guess, or five. One were the attorneys in the DOJ who wrote up these memos, which supposedly provided some type of legal cover for torture. There were the people who followed those memos. There were the people who requested those memos. And then there were at least 100 cases of people who didn't even follow the memos that allowed them to torture. This went beyond that. And then we're talking about an extra two that were special from that. So is there any sense that you have that the Obama administration was ever interested at all in pursuing any type of accountability for any of those people?
Well, it not only is it not my sense that they were, there's a mountain of evidence that makes plain that they weren't interested in doing that. They were, in fact, interested in ensuring there was no accountability. You can go all the way back to December 2008, before Obama was even inaugurated. There was an article in the New York Times through leaks of his transition team making clear that he was opposed to any attempt, as he called it, to look backward. There was an early January interview with George Stephanopoulos prior to his inauguration again, where he essentially said that he believes in looking forward, not backward. And then there was this period in the first several months of the Obama administration where people were wondering whether there would be investigations, where people like Rahm Emanuel and Robert Gibbs were publicly pressuring the Justice Department. These are political operatives pressuring what's supposed to be an independent Justice Department not to commence any investigations by repeatedly stating that Obama was opposed to those investigations. And to me, the most remarkable thing about this is not only that they were making clear that they don't want any criminal investigations, they aggressively blocked every form of accountability. So remember, in 2009, it was the Democrats who controlled both the Senate and the House. They were the chair of every single committee. A few of them were suggesting that they wanted to do a formal subpoena-driven investigation into the torture regime. Obama, according to the New York Times and everybody else, blocked that by going to Capitol Hill and telling Democratic leaders he wanted no such congressional investigation. Victims of the torture regime repeatedly sued Bush officials in court and Bush lawyers in court, like John Yoo and Donald Rumsfeld, The Obama Justice Department continuously intervened and demanded that federal courts dismiss those cases on the grounds of secrecy and immunity, and succeeded in blocking any civil accountability. So WikiLeaks diplomatic cables had revealed that Republican officials worked with Obama State Department officials even to block investigations in other countries such as Spain and Germany, whose citizens had been victimized by this torture regime and wanted to investigate, and they succeeded in coercing those countries to shut down their investigation as well. So across the board, internationally, congressionally, civilly, and criminally, the Obama Justice Department and the rest of the Obama administration succeeded in blocking any and all form of accountability or even investigative transparency for what happened.
So this was not simply a question of the Obama administration didn't want to use its resources to pursue this. It used its resources, in fact, to make sure that nobody pursued it.
Precisely. And, you know, there's, you know, you can talk about reasons why this happened, and there's evidence for that. I mean, one is that, remember that lots of Democrats were implicated in this torture regime. The Washington Post reported that early on, several Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi, Jane Harman, Jay Rockefeller, the Intelligence Committee Democrats, were briefed on these programs by the CIA. None of them objected. Some of them even demanded to know why more wasn't being done. Jane Mayer said that, you know, the problem with having the Democrats investigate is they know that many of their key leaders would be swept up in the investigation because of this complicity. And then there's the fact that, again, what the New York Times said pretty remarkably in December 2008 is that presidents are highly incentivized not to investigate the crimes of their predecessor in order to preserve this shield of immunity that presidents enjoy, knowing that they will at one point leave office. And they want to preserve this practice that presidents aren't held accountable for the crimes they commit in office. It's a self-interested motive that causes presidents to block investigations of their predecessors as well.
And we should say, I mean, to me, what is most damning, perhaps of all of it, in terms of the motives behind quashing this, because, you know, certainly people who hear, you know, a talk of this at this point say, well, look, the president couldn't do it because politically this would have gotten in the way of things. There's really no scenario where one could imagine an investigation into the Bush torture regime taking place in Spain could any way implicate or involve or hinder the political ambitions of President Obama, right? I mean, is there any scenario where someone could argue like, well, the president didn't quash Spain's investigation of this? I mean, this goes far beyond a notion of what is politically expedient or even arguably like, you know, what is emotionally healthy for the country. We're talking about another country who is pursuing this investigation.
Right. Well, let me say a few things about that excuse that it was politically untenable for Obama to allow investigations to go forward. First of all, as you just said, there are lots of investigations that he blocked that wouldn't at all have redounded politically on him. I mean, not just internationally. I mean, how would that have hurt him politically if Spain and Germany had tried to hold accountable American war criminals? But also even in the court process, even in the civilian courts of the United States, where victims of the torture regime had sued Bush officials, if those cases have simply proceeded to an adjudication of whether those officials broke the law and should be held accountable and liable, there's no conceivable theory that suggests that that would have reflected poorly on Obama politically or impeded his political agenda. And yet he blocked all of those forms of investigation and accountability, not just the criminal charges from the Justice Department. Secondly, you know, if you look at polls in the first several months of the Obama administration, before it became clear to everybody that Obama was against investigations, polls were actually fairly clear in an overwhelming way that the vast majority of Americans wanted some form of investigation into not just the Bush torture regime, but also the illegal eavesdropping program. It was something like 70% favored either criminal investigations or congressional investigations into those programs. Those polls only changed once it became clear that the Obama administration opposed those investigations. And then, of course, as usual, Democrats followed suit and began joining Republicans and opposing them. And only then did the polling start to change. And the third issue I would say is, I mean, you know, the Democrats claimed during the Bush years that one of the worst scandals of the Alberto Gonzalez rule in the Justice Department was politicizing the justice system, trying to use and manipulate the process of prosecutions for political ends. And yet what this excuse says is exactly that same mentality, which is that it doesn't matter what the rule of law says. It doesn't matter if the most egregious crimes were committed. What matters is President Obama's political standing. And if that political standing is harmed by applying the rule of law equally to our most powerful officials, then the political consideration should trump an independent judiciary and an independent justice system, and it should shield Bush officials from the consequences of their crime. Even if it were true, that excuse, which it isn't, but even if it were, it's an incredibly perverse and corrupted way of thinking, especially from a political movement that claimed to find the politicization of justice so offensive.
So let's, I mean, putting aside, I mean, I don't want to put aside the moral implications and the hypocrisy and the integrity considerations for a moment, but I want to look at this in a crass fashion, because I would go even further to say that it would have clearly behooved President Obama from a political standpoint to have investigations that were a function either of the civil courts or of the Spanish-German courts, whatever it is, you know, distinct from his administration. It would have definitely, it's hard to imagine it would not have politically behooved him had people reminded the American public just how horrible things were under the Bush administration. But leaving that aside, it raises the question as to why and what it says about what is going on systemically, that there would be no, that the administration would see no incentive even to allow anybody to investigate this going forward. And the fact that there was nothing that bubbled up from sort of long time. And I guess, well, let's move to that, because I think there was clearly some whistleblowers who stood up, and we can move on to that. But give me your sense as to the agenda. Like, why does the president in this instance want even not the political benefit that would come from this?
Well, you know, first of all, again, I would say that it wasn't such a clean division here between Republican war criminals on the one hand and Democratic angelic opponents on the other. It really was the case that many of these policies were bipartisan in nature and that they had the approval of the leadership in both political parties. So if you're President Obama and there are all these investigations or criminal procedures or civil procedures that are about to reveal what really happened, you have an incentive to protect your party leaders from being implicated in these extremely serious crimes that you've and your top officials spent the campaign denouncing. I also think that it really is the case that within the Washington culture, there is this view that criminal sanctions especially, but even more generally, investigative processes and the like, really are inappropriate when it comes to examining and punishing the illegal acts of our highest officials in office, that it's just some sort of overkill or kind of inappropriate fit, that criminal trials and prisons are for drug dealers who sell drugs on the street. They're for people who murder outside of the government. And so, you know, I think there's this prevailing sense in Washington that the criminal justice system just simply doesn't apply to people who wield power in Washington. And there's an interest, a cultural community interest in preserving this principle for obvious reasons of self-interest, that if you are someone who wields power in Washington, you benefit directly from this precept that says that that criminal punishments, criminal accountability, even investigative processes are not really appropriately applied to your conduct. And I think that's the reason why you saw a virtual consensus, almost unanimous among not just political figures in both parties, but media figures as well across the political spectrum in Washington that opposed any form of accountability and investigation, that really said we should just leave that in the past and look forward, because it really is one of the prime precepts of this Washington dogma, this Washington religion, that people who wield political power in the United States should not be held accountable in that way.
Now, just literally days after I think it was announced that there would not be any criminal prosecutions, and it apparently it doesn't seem much in terms of civil, on anybody who was engaged in any of this torture throughout those years. Human Rights Watch accused the U.S. government, I think it was literally like a day or two later, of covering up the extent of which waterboarding at secret CIA prisons in Libya of opponents of Gaddafi. Opponents of Gaddafi who are now in the Libyan government, I guess. And this, of course, is also off the table, right? I mean, they've never issued sort of a blanket pardon going forward. It's just been a practical pardon, hasn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, one of the obvious difficulties in implementing these policies, and then not just, you know, refusing to prosecute, but even to kind of continue to honor and admire the people who did it. I mean, you know, it was amazing to watch Condoleezza Rice, who was the chairperson of the meetings in the White House where these torture techniques were choreographed, as ABC News called it. That was where the principals meeting took place in the White House that she chaired, where torture was planned and implemented to the greatest detail, where even John Ashcroft said what we're doing in the White House with planning these torture techniques is going to bring about shame in the eyes of historians. To watch her, you know, go before the Republican convention and be feted by Democrats and Republicans alike as this honorable figure. So we've not only not criminally punished or investigated the people responsible, we continue to sort of make sure that they're enriched, they prosper, they're in positions of great authority, institutional prestige and the like. And that has obviously made it very difficult, even more difficult than before, to enforce these kind of taboos anywhere else in the rest of the world. I mean, obviously, it's impossible for the United States to demand that Libyans hold accountable their torturers when those Libyans were often torturing at our behest using the same techniques that the U.S. government authorized itself. And that's one of the reasons why this is so damaging. Even though the Obama administration has withdrawn the authorization for these techniques by refusing to hold any of the people responsible accountable, they virtually ensured that these techniques will be used again in the future because it's become legitimized as just another political disagreement at worst, whether or not these techniques should be used and not as something that may.
And it's not just torture, right? I mean, if you're basically saying there's no accountability for torturing people, what exactly is there accountability for? I mean, what is the message to whether you are U.S. military personnel, whether you are U.S. covert ops, whether you are lawyers in the Justice Department? I mean, what is it that they can do that will in some day have any type of implications, you know, if they've broken the law?
Right. I mean, we've seen this, you know, repeatedly. Even recently, there was the incident in Afghanistan where American troops, Marines, were caught urinating on the corpses of the Taliban soldiers or other Afghans whom they had killed. Also, others who had burned Qurans and sparked great riots and protests in that country. And the military announced that neither group of offenders would be subject to any criminal sanction. This is what continuously happens. Even if you look at the worst crimes that were committed in Iraq and Afghanistan as part of U.S. national security and foreign policy, you see virtually no criminal sanction at all. I mean, people who ended up killing detainees early on in the Bush administration were given a year or a year and a half in prison. The only repercussions that came from any torturers was from the Abu Ghraib scandal, just because of the necessity to punish somebody, where low-level soldiers were received relatively light punishments while the officials responsible for this regime were completely shielded. And you're right. What it does is it sends the signal that there basically is no level of wrongdoing, no matter how egregious, savage, and brutal, that will result in any real repercussions if you're doing it on behalf of or within the confines of the United States government. It really is a government that has established for itself this sort of imperial prerogative of lawlessness that says that whatever it is we do, by definition, is permissible. And the consequences of that are obvious.
You know, some people I've been reading about, you know, are referring to this, are talking about the idea that many, many times that when you have a situation like this, there is a, there's really a generational accountability project that, you know, guys like Pinochet, it takes a generation or two for this type of stuff to catch up with them. Do you think that we're ever going to see that? I mean, do you think that we're going to see in a couple of generations from now in this country some attempt by our leadership to look back and say, hey, this was a very problematic period in our history. We need to, at the very least, have some type of, I don't know, reconciliation commission or something to that effect?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say what, you know, will happen a generation from now. You know, I suppose you could look at it in one sense and say that there are certain crimes the United States government has committed in the last generation, probably the most egregious being the offensive war in Vietnam that killed millions of people, that there's some sense of national regret over that, although there was never really any real accountability for it. And if you look at things like the horrific covert war that the United States waged in Central America that was brutal and lethal in all sorts of ways, you know, the president who waged that, Ronald Reagan, is considered more or less a national hero. I think you it's hard to find real convincing evidence that there will ever come a point in time when the United States, which is a country that tends to view itself as exceptional and therefore shies away from any view that anything it did was actually criminal or evil. I mean, I think we're willing to acknowledge that certain policies like the war in Iraq or Vietnam were mistaken, meaning things that we shouldn't have done from the perspective of our own self-interest. But I think embedded within the American culture is the idea that we are a nation intrinsically good and therefore don't really commit bad and evil acts. We're very good at demanding that other countries hold their war criminals accountable. I mean, the Obama administration has gone to Indonesia, has gone to Kenya, has gone to other places and demanded that even recently committed war crimes be criminally punished by the governments of those countries. But that's something from which we tend to exempt ourselves, not just in a current way, but even retrospectively, even with the benefit of some historical space. So I'm really not convinced that that will happen. I think the only real prospect for any accountability, even in the sort of mid to longer term, would be some kind of an international tribunal or a country that finally decides that it's willing to risk standing up to the United States.
You know, we're recording this interview on September 11th, 2012. And today, or I guess it actually came out last night, there was a piece in the New York Times, an op-ed piece, by Kurt Eichenwald, and he it's essentially a reported piece, as far as I can tell, that he had done reporting where it became clear that George Bush, the famous August 6th presidential daily briefing, which said al-Qaeda determined to strike, turns out to be the denouement of a series of warnings that took place all that summer. And my sense is that this reporting is going to sort of revive this question as to the failure, at the very least, of the Bush administration to take this threat seriously and the failure of the 9/11 Commission to really let us know what led up to this. Does it strike you, and I suspect the loudest cries for this type of rehashing of what happened, and I'm all for it, is going to come from people who also say it's time to turn the page on torture. You know what I mean? Like there seems to me there's going to be an intense amount of hypocrisy here, where we should dig through the lessons supposedly we didn't learn in the lead up to 9/11, but we shouldn't dig through the lessons we learned after 9/11.
Well, one of the things that's really kind of remarkable is that the idea of the 9/11 Commission was supposed to be that given the magnitude of this attack, it was vital to have a comprehensive account of what took place that would be free of partisanship and that everyone could trust as the official version of the events. And even more than 10 years later, we're on the 11th anniversary today as we're talking, large parts of the 9/11 Commission report itself remain classified 11 years later. There have been very prominent politicians like Bob Graham, and who was the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman at the time, and others who have said that in particular the role of very influential Saudis in the attack and financing the groups and the terrorist circle responsible for these attacks have been very aggressively shielded by a U.S. government that continues to have this very close alliance with the Saudis. And so, you know, never mind a sort of future investigation, even the one we had is still very much suppressed in lots of material ways. And, you know, I'm not sure that there really is an outcry or will be an outcry. I think you'll hear some Democrats, you know, trying to exploit this newest revelation to blame the Republicans for the 9/11 attack. And as you say, exactly, that many of the same ones will be demanding that torture not be looked into on the grounds that we have to look forward and not backward. But I think that, you know, by and large, the country was successfully persuaded that the attack was essentially an act of evil by foreign radicals who hate the United States, and that, you know, the leadership of our country responded rather well. And I'm not sure there's really an opportunity, even given the large amounts of evidence, to change that narrative among large numbers of people.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to me, because I get the sense, I mean, I don't know if there'll be a large outcry, but it certainly will. There certainly will be conversation about it, and by people who sort of were so excited to turn the page. Do you think, I mean, what, faced with what the reality is now, I mean, what is, if there are any hopes for the future in terms of some measure of accountability, it seems to me it's just going to be a couple of dogged reporters, perhaps, you know, writing books and trying to maintain a legitimate account of what happened. Is that basically it? Or is this just down the wormhole forever?
Yeah, I think it's probably down the wormhole. You know, it reminds me a little bit of other historical events that some small segment of the society remain convinced had never really been fully and truthfully accounted for, like the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which even, you know, 50 years later produces lots of dissension, the Bay of Pigs attack, other kinds of historical events that never quite convince large a certain segment of the population, but convince most people that the truth had been disclosed and revealed. I think there's just a sort of desire to move on. I'll give you one really good example of that. I've written about this many times before. The anthrax attacks, you know, which arguably played as significant of a role as the 9/11 attack in keeping fear levels really high among Americans. I mean, right. You can really make the case that it did. Obviously, the FBI first charged somebody with being the anthrax attacker, Stephen Hatfield. They were certain that he did it, and ended up he was completely innocent. He won several million dollars from the government for having been falsely accused. Then the FBI says, we actually got the real person this time. It was a scientist within the U.S. Army, Bruce Ivins. And yet the more that case is examined, the more even the most mainstream sources like the Washington Post, the New York Times editorial page, Wall Street Journal, Nature Magazine, lots of different leading political figures from both parties say that the case against him is extremely dubious. And it is. And yet there's no call for an investigation of the type even that the 9/11 Commission had, because it's just a desire almost not to know, not to unravel all of that, to just leave that in the past. And I think that the government exploits that desire quite a bit, that once it packages an explanation that people come to terms with, there's really a desire not to be convinced that it's false, that not to believe that they've been deceived and that there's a whole nother set of realities out there that have yet to be uncovered. It's just it's a human desire, I think, to believe that you've been told the truth and that you haven't been duped. And I think that's a big part of why these things don't get reexamined.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I'm not sure that it's unique to the United States, but we seem to have at least a fairly prominent capacity, I think, to to ignore and deny certain things and move forward. I mean, I suppose that's a feature of other countries, but it seems like we are particularly adept at just nothing to see here. Keep moving along.
Well, I do find this fascinating. I think you're right. And I think, you know, a big part of this is there's a mythology that Americans have embraced about their own country and about their own government. And it basically teaches that while our government might do things inefficiently or even corruptly, that basically tyranny is something that only happens in other countries and propaganda is only something that happens in other countries. Americans believe that we have a free country, which means we have a free and vibrant press, that that acts of our government are subjected to real scrutiny and accountability through our institutions designed to check power, like courts and the media, and that, you know, this is an important thing for us to believe, that we are a beacon of freedom and press freedom, and that propaganda and tyranny and oppression only happens in these other countries like North Korea and Iran and whatever the U.S. enemy of the week is. And so to believe that that the American people have been radically deceived about critical historical events and that this truth has been hidden really calls into question all of those mythological assumptions about how we like to think of ourselves. And to really start believing that those things are true, we have to abandon those assumptions about how we think of ourselves. And that's an unpleasant and painful thing to do. And I think the desire to really embrace this exceptionalism by continuing to believe that basically the truth is being told to us by our government and by our media, and that aids and abets the ability to deceive in a fairly fundamental way.
We're sort of veering off here, but do you think that's sort of like that's almost baked into the cake of the American psyche? I mean, you know, I'm thinking of like just the Andrew Jackson's Indian removal and the just sort of how much, I'm just trying to think of what would have been in, you know, the early days of the United States sort of created that dynamic. And I don't know, maybe that dynamic has been there. It just seems that in some way we seem to have lost our capacity to sort of reconcile certain things, which other countries seem to have a better sense of doing. But maybe I'm just imagining that they have a better sense.
You know, it's interesting. You can pick up the New York Times, you know, any day, and you'll see articles decrying the censorship and the propaganda to which other countries' citizens are subjected. And we love to read about that. We love to think that people in the Muslim world are propagandized, that, you know, people in Iran are deprived of all kinds of basic core liberties and freedoms. We love to think about and to denounce that kind of propaganda and oppression in other places. But it's much more difficult to pick up the New York Times and find discussions of the way in which citizens are propagandized or tyrannized or oppressed taking place in the United States, which would obviously be a much more valuable discussion. And so the effect of that, this sort of taboo about the United States in those terms, is that it continuously reinforces the belief that these sorts of things only happen elsewhere, and that our ability to denounce them and our willingness and eagerness to denounce them is yet more proof that we are free of those things. And the fact that it simultaneously flatters us and also relieves us of the obligation to do anything about it in front of us, because if we tell ourselves that these kind of things don't happen here, then we obviously have no pressure to stand up to them or to work against them. All of these circumstances combine to mean that we not only are constantly told that these things don't happen here, but that we have an emotional desire to believe that they don't as well and are willing to sort of go along with it. I do think you find a lot more self-criticism and self-awareness, even in those places that we are constantly told are propagandized and not subject to a free to a free debate and a free press, than you do in the United States. Part of that is, as you suggest, just kind of embedded in the DNA of how we thought of ourselves from the founding as this extraordinary, exceptional country that created itself out of nothing by, you know, casting aside the world's most powerful empire at the time. and creating this document that would preserve liberty in this unique way. But part of it is too, there's a sort of complacency that sets in, I think, when you're the richest country on earth and are constantly told that you're free to keep believing that it's true.
Well, Glenn Greenwald, I've got to run and catch the latest episode of America's Got Talent. Because
I don't want to stop you from that. I would feel really guilty.
Glenn Greenwald, always a pleasure. Now at The Guardian UK. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Sam. Bye.
Bye-bye.